Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
The reason I got into politics was because I had watched so many of my friends who I had grown up with who had farms lose their farms. And it was frustrating to see some of the programs in place that were not conducive with a free market, allowing people to be successful, but it was always so dependent on the government. And allowing the government to play a role that is assistive, supportive, making sure that we have access to markets, but in no way, shape, or form disadvantaging one against the other.
California Representative David Valadao.
It's something that I take very seriously. And stuff that we put in the farm bills over the years has been helpful. But I think GT is doing his due diligence. I think he's doing a great job in making sure that he's asking all the right questions so that when we have the opportunity to actually move forward with that final package, it'll be something that'll be good for agriculture across the board.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I want to look backwards a little bit, and the Congressional Research Service has helpfully compiled the last 20 plus years of actual spending under the farm bills going back to 1990.
Jonathan Kappas is a former administrator of USDA's Farm Service Agency, is an ag policy expert at the University of Illinois.
And then it has added, and this is from a couple years ago, so it's a little bit dated, it has added the projected spending that CBO had back in 2019. What I think we take away from this is another snapshot of the politics and the challenges in negotiating and moving a farm bill through Congress, as well as some of the policy trends in this bill. And so if we start at the bottom of this chart, the conservation programs we see having steadily increased in spending since 1990, which makes sense because the current conservation suite of programs was authorized in 1985. And so we've increased in the programs, we've increased funding as we went since 1985 and 1990. So pretty standard upward, simple upward trend there. The red bars are our Title I commodity programs, the farm support, safety net, subsidies, whatever titles you want to use for them. And you can see the countercyclical nature of those. You know, when prices are low or revenues are low, we see higher spending under those. When prices are doing well, you see a lot less spending under the Title I programs, particularly since 2014 when the direct payment program went away. These are much more dependent on the markets and what prices are doing, at least on a national average across a 12-month marketing year. And then finally, the blue bars are the third bucket of mandatory spending for farm policy, and that is the crop insurance program, which has really taken off since the massive reform effort in 2000 that increased premium assistance, increased participation as a result.
Obviously, there's no getting around the largest outlay to the farm bill.
What stands out to everybody are the food assistance or SNAP outlays in the, I think those are kind of an orangish color, salmon maybe, I don't know. That has grown substantially since 2008 in the Great Recession. Of course, the pandemic will have also impacted this, and so we will see an increase in that in the CBO baseline. Sometimes what we get lost in these big numbers are the realities of these two programs, and we are serving roughly above 40 million Americans who are low income, who are struggling to put food on the table, and the SNAP program provides them direct assistance to purchase food and who help then manage that series of challenges at the household and individual level. So it isn't, if all we do is look at the dollars, we tend to over-focus on SNAP as a blunt amount of spending. But when you think about the number of people who are being helped by this and being helped to purchase food, I think it puts that program in a different context.
So why is baseline so important to a farm bill debate?
And what is critical about baseline for a farm bill is that under the statute, under the federal budget statutes, CBO is required to assume the bill as it currently is written, does not change for 10 years into the future. And then they model all of the expected spending under that statutory outlet or that statutory scheme, assuming no changes. So we're looking at roughly $120 to up to $130 billion a year. So in a 10-year budget window, that will come out as a $1.3 trillion price tag. But again, remember that's 10 years. That's not $1 trillion every year going out the door.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
From World Ag Expo 2023, I'm Tony St. James, and we ran into Paul Mikesell. Paul is the founder and CEO of Carbon Robotics and the Laser Weeder. Is that right?
Laser Weeder, yep, correct, yeah. And I am Paul Mikesell. Hello.
Okay, so Paul, tell us a little, first off, about the company and how you came up with the company.
Been working on the Laser Weeder for 4 years. We realized that AI and robotics needed to get into agriculture. So we dove in head first and just kept going and working hard until we figured out what would work. What works for weed control? AI, computer visions, and really high-powered lasers. So our machines, we find those weeds in the fields live. Our AI system is evaluating what it's seen in the camera. It says weed, weed, weed. It puts the lasers on them, kills all the weeds, keeps your field clean. No herbicides, no people out there pulling weeds. It's a win-win.
Now, so when we talk about weeds, what's the technology that goes behind, say, whether it's a corn or cotton?
Yeah.
First off, I guess what commodities are you in?
Sure,
and
yeah.
How does it know it's a weed?
Yeah, okay, great. So we focus a lot on specialty and vegetable crops. So we do a lot of onions, broccolis, cauliflowers, a lot of lettuces, spinach, spring mix, that kind of thing, a lot of carrots. We've done some organic corn, some organic soy, that kind of stuff. Typically, you're kind of higher value crops where they're gonna, and we've got some videos here of these are spinaches, really high density spinaches. So how does it know what's a weed, what's a crop? So this is a subsection of AI called deep learning. These are deep learning neural nets. It's the same kind of technology that like ChatGPT, you probably heard about that. So that's a neural net. So we use a computer vision version of that same kind of technology. We take a bunch of images. We tell the computer, this is a weed, this is a crop, this is a weed, this is a crop. Computer learns that. And then we take that piece of the computer that has learned that, put it in the robot, connect it up to the lasers. Here we go.
Wow. Yep. Okay, so if we were using herbicides, we'd have to be refilling the tank. Do you have to refill the laser?
No, those lasers are good. They're self-contained. They run. We just put some voltage into it. Out comes a mix of plasma, and that creates heat energy. And our machine knows how to put that heat energy right on the right spot of the plant to burn it and make it die. No refill on the lasers. They're good, sealed, self-contained unit.
Okay, so you were here last year.
Yeah.
What's different?
Yeah, this is the same laser weeder we brought out last year. So what's different? We've added a lot of software functionality. So there's a lot of new crop models. So we can do over 40 crops now. And the big thing is that we're announcing this year, just announced actually, we do not only laser weeding, but we'll also do laser thinning. So if you want to go out and you want to thin your crops to stand, we can do that. So we can clean out your weeds and thin your crops at the same time. The laser weeder can do it all. And that's doable just with the software upgrade. So we did the hardware once and we did it right. And then new software on top of that, on top of the existing hardware platform.
So you're already out in the field, multiple states. What states?
We got machines right now in California, Arizona, New Mexico, Washington. And then this year, we're deploying to about 6 or 7 new states in the United States. Got some machines going to Canada. We're going to ship about 3 to 4 times as many machines this year as we did last year. So we're really ramping up volume to keep up with demand for the laser weeder.
Wow. We want to find you. Where do we do that?
CarbonRobotics.com. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on YouTube. You can find us on Twitter, all the social media networks. Hopefully, you'll find us in a field near you soon.
Paul, great to see you.
Great.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Paul Mikesell is the founder and CEO of Carbon Robotics and the Laser Weeder. From World Ag Expo 2023, I'm Tony St. James.
This is Agriculture Today.
Over the next 3 to 5 years, you can see from the cycle peak to the cycle trough, typically you have about 1.25 to 1.5 million drop in cow slaughter. What's that going to mean for cull cow values?
Speaking at the recent Cattle Facts Outlook Seminar, Kevin Good with Cattle Facts.
Obviously, it's going to lift them higher. Trim prices, all beef prices. And then also, as we have the conversation about leverage and margin, obviously that helps the cattle producer as we get into those tighter supplies, not on the cow side, but as we look at the Fed side too.
When looking at harvest projections, Good says,
from a big picture standpoint, looking at harvest for this year, we're suggesting a drop of basically 800,000 head, about 3%. And if you think about my comments earlier, Your beef cow herd from the most recent peak is down 2.5 million head. What's slaughter going to look like over the next 3 to 4 years? Obviously, as we get into 24, 25, 26, particularly as we start to keep the heifers back, we're going to have a massive drop on an annual basis. That comes back to the leverage and margin conversation we'll have a little bit later. From a seasonal standpoint, we would suggest that this year seasonality on supply will be our tightest supplies in here over the next couple months. Seasonally, it will grow through the summer, and they get tighter again as we go into late year. As we talk about price, we're going to suggest it's going to be a fairly seasonal type year. We'll walk through that in a few minutes. But I think the point here is it's substantially below a year ago, and it's also starting to run below the five-year average. So we are in the stage of the cycle where supplies will get tighter consistently as we go over the next 3 to 4 years. So as you roll that together, you can look at the math there. We basically have an 800,000 head drop in fed, 800,000 head drop in non-fed. We've got weights for the year a little bit heavier. Recognize the weather is having a major impact, in particular the northern feeding regions here in the first quarter. Offsetting that, though, for the year with that many less cows in the mix, this is cold carcass weight, so that will bring that weight up with less cows in the mix. The bottom line is a huge drop in production, 1.3 billion pounds, close to 5%. And if we go from our peak in 22 to our forecast out in 25 for a longer term view, we would suggest that drop is going to be a full 10%. So think about that when it comes back to the value proposition.
When looking at export and import numbers,
from a trade standpoint, this past year actually ended up being a good year for us. Record tonnage, record value was exported, up 3% when it's all said and done. You can see as we go through the next couple of years with tighter supplies, more than likely it's going to be hard to export quite as much product. We would still suggest the dollar value will be record high again this year, but probably a little bit less tonnage. Still optimistic that we'll continue to see gains into China, primarily, and be able to hold our own in South Korea and Japan. On the import side, we do need to expect to see more product coming in. If we're going to harvest 1.25 to 1.5 million less cows over the next couple of years, the market will be looking for more trim. Australia's built their herd back up, so you have to expect more product to come in from Australia. We have to continue to expect more product to come in from not only Mexico, but South America as a longer term trend in here as we go forward.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Two things that we focus on, and I don't think they've changed really from 1 year to the next in the last 2 years. If we don't have a functioning supply chain and a reliable water supply, there's almost no point to anything else that we're doing.
Aubrey Betancourt is president and CEO of the Almond Alliance.
So those are our tier one priorities when it comes to almond farming in California and in the United States. So as we look at that, we've had an interesting change, and this is typical of the irrigated West. Here we are on the Mediterranean climate. That's what allows us to grow almonds the way we do. But that means we get our rain and snow in the winter, and then that sustains us through the drier summer months. We don't get rain in the summer like you do in other parts of the country. And so the ability to capture, store, and move that water reliably is what has made California one of the largest ag economies in the world, and what has allowed the almond industry specifically to become the size and scale that it is and to be sustained as such. When we have various regulatory challenges or actual challenges from years of drought that have allowed that system to not function in the way that it's supposed to, our reservoirs and our canals, it leaves us at a deficit, and it leaves us having to kind of get ourselves out of that. So when we get into a year like this where we have abundant snow and abundant rain, 9 atmospheric rivers hitting us at the same time, it's about using that existing system and making sure the policies and the regulations that administer that system allow us to capture, store, and move that water for the time of dry and to recover our aquifers so that we can replenish that system and keep us in kind of this holistic, what I call total portfolio water management. And so we're really pushing in this space where we have the water supply structure and laws that are very out of date, trying to keep up with our modern technology and our modern demand and our modern relationship to the resource. So we're really working with state and federal officials to modernize not only the infrastructure itself, but also the policies that administer it to allow for more reliable water supply and true climate resilience is the ability to deliver water and the ability to protect from flood, and that's what the system's designed to do. So we need to update that to keep up with our new challenges and changes.
Last year, it was a major supply chain issue.
A year ago, we had a lot of product that was sold here in the United States, over 900 million pounds. To put that into scale, we produce anywhere from 2.6 to 3 billion pounds a year. We had almost 940 million pounds that we had sold but couldn't move. And our season starts August 1, so we had a short window to get this product off our shores. Why is that a crisis for us? Because our farmers don't get paid until that product gets delivered. So we were facing a total socioeconomic tragedy if we couldn't get that product off our shores. Through some interesting dynamics, opening up new channels, what we call a multimodal, multi-port strategy, where before we sent almost 80% of our ag product out of the Port of Oakland, we decided, well, let's meet the boats where they are. If they aren't going to come to Oakland and pick up our product, let's go down to L.A. and get on the boat there. Let's go out to Houston and get on the boat there. Let's go out to Norfolk and Savannah and Newark and get on the boat there. Well, how are we going to get there? Well, now we go multimodal. Okay, trucks are great. How about rail? We partnered with the Union Pacific, started moving product in containers around to get them closer to our farms, away from the congestion at the ports, and get our product out through other avenues and channels. We were able to move a lot of that product. We had some issues with port strikes and some labor issues that maybe have slowed us down a little bit. But now we have more of what I call Legos on the table. So this year we do have a lot of crop sitting again. We have about 800 million pounds that we need to move. That being said, we're ahead of the game and we have new partners and we have new strategy. So we feel a little bit more confident in the ability to move the product, but this year the global market's different. And so now trade is rising as a higher priority for us. And so the ability to sell product when the dollar is so strong as an export crop is a little difficult. But our industry, I would tell you, they're resilient. They know these are tough times and we're just going to need to keep moving product in order for us to get through this phase. Same as the water. We got to get through the drought to get to the flood so we can get into the next phase and right size and keep moving forward.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
First time to the big farm show. I go to the one in Colusa sometimes, but this will be quite a treat. Plus having all our colleagues out here, including our chairman and our speaker. Pretty cool.
Representing the 1st Congressional District of California, member of the House Ag Committee, Doug LaMalfa.
Well, you know, we don't have to explain to Speaker McCarthy about ag and its importance and the water supply and energy and all those things that come from the state that make our economy go and keep food on the table for people. So we already have a head start. And our new chairman, G.T. Thompson from Pennsylvania, he gets it. He's done a lot of great work. He's done a lot of great work on a lot of aspects of the farm bill. So we're kind of off to a good start, even though we're behind from not enough work getting done on farm bill in the previous few years. So that said, you know, we got really good input from real people here today that helped us to focus our thoughts a little bit. And it really boils down to a lot of the conversation today was on trade and the importance of expanding markets and keeping the water flowing, as I've been just passionate about. You know, even talking to the president, the last two State of the Unions about that, you know, like, we got to get water supply here. It can't all just go out to the ocean for a dubious environmental purpose that doesn't actually fill any.
Speaking at World Ag Expo in Tulare, California, talks about improving the forestry title of the Farm Bill.
Yes, I've been honored to receive the chairmanship of the Subcommittee on Forestry of the Ag Committee. The Ag Committee has jurisdiction over, obviously, the USDA. The U.S. Forest Service is in the USDA, so that's the connection. So I think what's really, really important is to get U.S. Forest Service cracking on taking care of its lands. It has nearly 200 million acres of forest lands in this country, and they're not moving fast enough on, I call it, the pace and scale of treating, meaning thinning, meaning putting the forest to a sustainable amount of trees per acre that it can withstand a little bit of drought, have the water supply of the trees need to be strong and healthy instead of weakened and insect-prone, and that kills the trees, and then, boom, you have hundreds of thousands of acres of extremely fire-prone forestry. In 2021, when there's a million-acre fire in my district, million-acre fire, the Dixie Fire, the firefighters were telling us they had not seen the dry index conditions like they had, which just made it explosive. They'd never seen anything like it. The fire, any bit of wind and a little bit of hot day, it would just explode across the landscape. And so that means we have a lot of work to do. We need to, the federal government needs to step up and do its job and pay what it takes to do the forestry treatments that need to be done. And we need to take all this material and turn it into a byproduct that's useful. Whether we chip it and send it overseas, where the people in the Pacific Rim use it for their energy. Turn it into a use, especially these dead trees that are standing there. Chip this stuff, move it out. Make saw logs where we need saw logs, whatever it takes. And make biomass usable in this country to make energy as well. We have obviously a grid that is on the edge at all times here in California. And they want to take out some of the hydroelectric dams in my district, which is foolish because that's everybody's worried about CO2 free. Well, those don't make any CO2. They got a 5-year reprieve on Diablo Canyon, which is CO2 free out of that nuclear plant. So we got to put our heads together and actually start focusing on what's important and what works for our economy and for our people. And that includes taking this biomass material and making it a plus instead of a negative when it just goes up in smoke every year.
Again, representing the 1st Congressional District of California, member of the House Ag Committee from World Ag Expo, that was Doug LaMalfa. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I think if you look at everything in totality, beef demand in the United States was at, you know, some of the highest levels it's been in 30 years. So, and that doesn't come by accident.
Greg Haynes is CEO of the Cattlemen's Beef Board, says there are success stories.
There's a lot of other proteins out there competing. You've got all these alternative meats. You know, these companies have had billions of dollars in venture capital and trying to promote themselves and to knock beef down. And we're coming out on head. And I think that's just shows the, you know, the information that's out there. The consumer knows, hey, this is delicious. They're seeing that it's nutritious. They're seeing it's safe. They see that it's sustainable. And so I think that's really helping to kind of keep that demand. So we need to keep pushing that. But a lot of these programs, I think, going forward, we've got, you know, the Beef It's What's for Dinner campaigns that are constantly going. 2 weeks from now is going to be the Beef It's What's for Dinner 300 race at Daytona. So that's the day before the Daytona 500, and it's all dedicated to beef. And it's amazing. Just you've got the impact of all the people at the race. You've got all the social media. You got the influencers. You've got, you know, news and radio reporting and all this kind of linked into it. So it really creates a big impact kind of activity that's going to be happening. And that ties in then to all the other campaign and materials, you know, tied into the Beef It's What's for Dinner. So all this is leveraged, you know, moving forward to keep that in front of the consumers and having them select beef.
Now, the Cattlemen's Beef Board, or CBB, makes investments on behalf of cattlemen, but how do they make sure they're getting a positive ROI?
I think evaluation is incredibly important. You know, we need to show to the producers or who are paying into this that these programs are having an impact. We're not just doing stuff to do it. And so we have a very active evaluation committee. And so every program that's out there has to report back quarterly on set goals and targets that they had set originally when that activity was approved. So they're reporting back on that, and we're tracking that quarterly, and we come out with an annual report too. And that annual report we just actually released 2 days ago. So that's on our website if anybody wants to see it. It's pretty easy to read, but it gives you really a lot of great detail on the impact that these various programs are having. We do that, but another thing that we just started a couple years ago, we call these third-party independent analysis. And so we've hired an outside contractor to come in, and each year we select just a handful of programs, and we do a deeper dive into them. And so the goal here is to look at the programs, like what's working, maybe what's not working. You know, are there other things that we could be doing to enhance this? And so we're not trying to, you know, criticize the contractors or whatever, but I think anytime you have, you know, an outside set of eyes looking at something, it may spur some, you know, some new concepts or different things you can be doing. So our goal with this is just to really drive that continuous improvement, get the biggest impact we can have for every checkoff dollar that we're collecting, and, you know, really get that bang for the buck and create that demand for beef. So all those have been set up to do that. Again, it's very transparent. Our producers can see what's happening with that. And we also do another return on investment study every 5 years. So we had one done in 2020. We're going to start the next one in 2024. But the impact of that has always been good. You know, the last one showed that for every dollar we're investing, we're really getting $12 back of impact to the industry. And that's pretty significant. So I think all this really shows that the checkoff's heading in the right direction and having an impact on that consumer demand.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The word that best describes USDA's latest global corn production forecast, Argentina.
We reduced our corn production forecast by 5 million tons. That's currently at 47 million tons. They've been suffering a pretty severe drought through most of that planting season up until fairly recently. In late January, they started getting some beneficial rains.
World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jankowski explained some of the impacts to the world corn balance sheet.
Dominates the supply side, tightening up supplies by about 4.2 million tons. And then on the demand side, we reduced corn feed use by 3.8 million tons. And that mainly reflects lower feed use in Argentina.
And a lowering of global corn ending stocks from the previous month. Meanwhile, the U.S. corn ledger showed minimal changes and no change to the season ending average price, still at $6.70 a bushel. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.